Welcome back to the Existential Echo Chamber podcast. I'm going to be continuing doing the readings of my blog posts. And for those of you who are new, welcome. Thank you for joining us. After I am done uploading my blog series, we will be transitioning to talking about politics, movie reviews, television reviews, all sorts of fun stuff. So stick around. This is not just a podcast about religion, philosophy, history, although it is a big chunk of that. So if you're interested in all of these different things and having these big picture conversations about life, then this is the podcast for you. Thank you for everyone who's been listening so far, and I'm going to go ahead and jump right into the next post. The next post I wrote on Friday, April the 3rd, 2020. It's called Jesus Christ, Apocalyptic Superstar. As I watched in the night visions, I saw one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. To him was given dominion and glory and kingship that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that shall not pass away, and his kingship is one that shall never be destroyed. Daniel 7:13-14. Again, the high priest asked him, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" Jesus said, "I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." Mark 14:61-62. Jesus Christ, who are you? What have you sacrificed? Jesus Christ, superstar. Do you think you're what they say you are? Jesus Christ, superstar. The core of Christianity is not dependent upon the historical reliability of the Bible. It's not concerned with where the ideas of heaven and hell came from, and it's not even, strictly speaking, all that focused on God, per se. The beating heart of Christianity is supplied lifeblood by one simple idea. Jesus was sent by God to save the world from sin by dying on the cross, and on the third day, he rose from the dead. The entire message of the New Testament can be summed up, according to most mainstream believers, by that simple notion. And as somebody who used to be absolutely convinced in no uncertain terms that Jesus came back from the dead 3 days after his crucifixion, there could be no escaping the obvious implication of that fact. Jesus is the Son of God. And for a Christian, that means Jesus is divine. About 5 or 6 years ago, when I first stopped believing in a literal second coming of Jesus in my lifetime, and shortly after I started to realize that I could trace the origins of not only belief in the Christian concept of the afterlife, but also of the entity known as Yahweh back to specific places and times in ancient history, I began to feel my faith evolve. It's not that I ceased to believe, on the contrary, I remained very committed to what I viewed as the proper understanding of being a Christian, and as my thinking about the relationship between Scripture and my sincerely held beliefs began to shift, the one fixed landmark I clung to with full conviction was the divinity of Jesus, as evidenced by his resurrection. If that part is literally true, then the rest of it is true enough for me. I have not forgotten that I began to talk a little bit about the afterlife a few posts back, and I promise the punchline is coming. But before I can explain to you where most scholars believe the Christian understanding of heaven and hell originated, I have to explain to you why these beliefs were not the view of Jesus and his earliest followers. To do that, in turn, I will have to explain to you what most scholars of the New Testament have to say about the historical Jesus, i.e. the portrait of the actual man who lived in Palestine 2,000 years ago, that can be sketched out by applying rigorous historical criteria to the surviving sources to help determine, wherever possible, what Jesus most likely said or did versus what the early church claimed he said or did. This post would quickly become very long, very tedious, and very technical if I tried to explain to you the nature of how and why hundreds of years of academic research that I barely comprehend myself, coupled with the careful application of carefully constructed historical criteria, demonstrates the likelihood that these scholars are correct. So, I will not even attempt it. If you would like to delve into the process of learning this stuff for yourself, I will happily recommend a half dozen books from which I personally began to perceive this historical academic portrait of Jesus. Remember, I am not the expert. I am not a scholar. I am only sharing what I have come to understand from years of independent research, thinking, debating, and gnashing of teeth. Likewise, it would be pointless in this post to even take up the issue of whether or not Jesus existed as a historical figure. Aside from a very small minority of scholars called mythicists, virtually every mainstream New Testament scholar and almost every major research university in the United States and throughout Europe agrees that Jesus existed. Whether he did or not, in my view, is actually not all that significant for this particular discussion. Why? Because one way or the other, the world spins today under the very firm assumption that he did. And belief in Jesus has been one of the chief forces driving the development of Western thought for the past two millennia. In other words, if Jesus did not exist, he might as well have, because his non-existence has done absolutely nothing to slow down his impact on Western civilization and the shape of human history at large. As it is, scholars widely agree that Jesus of Nazareth did exist, and that we can probably know certain things about him with a relative degree of probability. Leaving aside this rather uninteresting and, in my personal opinion, goofy debate, I will now try to provide a brief, I promise, sketch of the life and teachings of the historical Jesus that actual experts and scholars have come to accept as probably being correct. In order to do so, I'm afraid I will have to disrespect the memory of C.S. Lewis by dismantling his strongest argument for faith in Jesus, the so-called trilemma. As I mentioned earlier, for me, my faith always rested on the conviction that Jesus is God, and there were two very compelling lines of thought that I always used to articulate any time somebody questioned my faith. The first is that Jesus was executed by Roman governor Pontius Pilate. People receive capital punishment for causing trouble. Therefore, Jesus must have caused some trouble. In my mind, running around calling yourself God, stirring up large crowds, and threatening to bring judgment on unbelievers certainly would qualify as disturbing the peace. The second and more popular argument is the aforementioned trilemma. It goes like this. Jesus claimed to be God. This is a vital claim that all people should consider carefully. Because what if he is God? Given this crucial question that we are all confronted with, there can be only three possible solutions, hence why it was called the trilemma. Option A, he was telling the truth, which makes him Lord. Option B, he was not God, but intentionally led people astray, making him a liar. Option C, or he was sincere in his grandiose beliefs about his identity, but was sincerely wrong, in which case he would be a certifiable lunatic. So, he was either Lord, liar, or lunatic. And C.S. Lewis would insist that those are the only three options available to us. I must admit, It's a formidable proposition if, and only if, one rules out the rather obvious fourth option, that the stories early Christians told about Jesus reflected posthumous theological developments, not historical reality. In which case, everything we think we know about Jesus is really the portrait of a legend. I don't think Jesus was Lord, liar, or a lunatic. I'm not suggesting that his existence is legendary. What I am proposing is that Jesus never actually claimed to be God, and therefore our understanding of who he really was cannot be subject to any arbitrary trilemma that apologists, even respected ones like C.S. Lewis, would wish to foist upon us. If he never claimed to be God, you might be asking, why did his followers believe that he was? Why does the New Testament indicate that he's divine? Well, the answer is relatively simple. His early followers came to believe he had been raised from the dead. Unfortunately, I will need to hold my breath on that particular subject at the moment, because it is jumping way too far ahead. We need to backpedal a bit. I've just dropped what is probably a bombshell for some of my readers, so I am obligated to unpack it. If Jesus didn't claim to be God, then what the heck was his message? Why did he die on the cross? Let not your hearts be troubled, friends. I am about to begin to explain. Jesus of Nazareth was an apocalypticist. Simply put, this means he believed the world was about to end. Jesus therefore built his ministry around this message. He called his message the good news, or the gospel. The good news had nothing to do with Jesus dying. He probably wanted to avoid that for as long as possible, like anybody else. It also had nothing to do with saving souls from hell. Jesus didn't think anybody died and went to hell. What Jesus believed, and what he taught his disciples, is that the world had fallen under the control of powerful, evil, demonic forces. These cosmic forces were at war with Yahweh and his angels, and the evidence of this colossal supernatural conflict was the suffering of the Jewish people on earth. Jesus believed that the reason bad things happened to good people is that a particularly nasty force called sin had wreaked havoc on the earth, leading people away from the worship of Yahweh and the true interpretation of the law of Moses. For Jesus, sin was not simply doing something bad or breaking a commandment. Sin was a powerful, demonic cancer that destroyed everything it came in contact with and resulted in death, physically and spiritually. Likewise, Jesus blamed political suffering on demonic forces of darkness. Demons possessed the evil Roman emperor and his minions, like cosmic puppeteers dangling them all on strings, manipulating and empowering them to oppress the chosen people of God as a ground warfare reflection of the battle raging in heaven. And it didn't stop there. Every disease, natural disaster and calamity that befell the Jews was a result of these demonic forces at work in the world. Into this chaos, Jesus brought a message of hope. It would all be over soon. God had heard the cries of his occupied people, much as he had centuries earlier when he had delivered the Hebrews from slavery in Egypt. And just as he had delivered the exiles from Babylonian chains, he was about to intervene once and for all, destroy the Romans, and restore the kingdom of Israel. But this would be no ordinary kingdom. It would be a utopian kingdom of peace, ruled over by an anointed champion of God, a ruler some Jews referred to as the Messiah. Jesus preached that God would accomplish this great victory by sending a powerful heavenly being called the Son of Man, along with an army of angels, to overthrow Rome and cleanse the world of God and Israel's enemies. In light of these events happening very soon, within his own lifetime, Jesus urged anyone among his fellow Jews who would listen to change their ways and focus on preparing for the coming kingdom. The way to do this was to follow the correct interpretation of God's law. That is to say, to follow the message and example of Jesus. Jesus probably viewed himself as many things: prophet, healer, exorcist, son of God, and yes, probably in some sense the Messiah. But we need to ask ourselves, what did these terms mean to Jesus? What did first century Jews understand him to mean when he made such claims? How was that message received? How did Jesus find himself in the crosshairs of the Roman Empire? Who was Jesus anyway? Where did he come from? How did he come to embrace his apocalyptic theology? Where did he get such lofty ideas about himself? And how did this message get twisted by later Christians into the message preached in churches throughout the world today? And how does this relate to heaven and hell, to the resurrection? And more to the point for this blog, how did I react when I learned all of this? How did it influence my thinking, change how I read the Bible, and impact my faith? Stay tuned. I'm getting there. I promise.